Well, you always hear us say that news reporting is different on WKAR and on NPR. Different and better. I can't think of a better illustration of what makes it different than the kind of story NPR chose to report earlier this morning. When given a choice between a child having good manners or having empathy, more parents choose, which one do you think it is? It's good manners. They choose the manners over it. Now, younger parents, I think that starts to skew differently, but it's just perfectly captures the kind of reporting that you get on public radio, courtesy of WKAR. One more reason of the dozens to call in with your contribution now at 517-353-5000. Current State is back for Monday. We're glad you're here. A recent investigation by today's first two guests helps shed light on dark money in Michigan politics. MLive reporter Emily Lawler, working with Craig Mauger of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network, helped to show how common so-called 527 accounts are among elected officials in the Michigan legislature. The accounts enable those officials and other campaign organizations to raise money, legally, that sometimes cannot be traced. Critics contend 527s mean Michigan legislators potentially can be bought and sold. Emily Lawler joins me now. Hi, Emily.
Hi.
And Craig Mauger joins me on the telephone. Good morning, Craig.
Good morning to you.
Emily, explain the mechanics, if you will, of a 527 account. You present a typical scenario in your MLive story from last week involving Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff. Describe that, please, so listeners can get a handle on the mechanics of how these work.
Yeah, so the Senate and actually the whole Michigan legislature was deciding on a package of bills that would give a tax break to data centers late last year. And after they decided on that package, a $10,000 donation from the company who kind of spurred the legislation showed up in Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekhoff's administrative account.
And we'll make clear at the outset that elected officials from both parties are apt to maintain these accounts. We cited Senator Meekhoff, who's a Republican, but Craig, you also found that two Lansing area Democrats also have these, and that's no surprise to anyone who's aware of these accounts, Andy Shore and Sam Singh. There are some limitations here. What can the dollars in a 527 account be used for, and what's not allowed?
Yeah, definitely. I'll just stipulate at the start of this comment that our investigation looked at both 527 accounts and nonprofit organizations tied to lawmakers. So with a 527 account, these are often used to pay for administrative expenses that lawmakers have, like their professional costs of holding office. Some of them use them to reimburse themselves for going to a conference or for traveling to an event somewhere in Michigan. The nonprofits are often used for what the lawmakers describe as charitable expenses. So let's say they're invited to attend a Right to Life dinner or a Planned Parenthood event. They would pay for the ticket to that event through their nonprofit account, and they would consider that charitable work because they're donating to a charitable organization. Other lawmakers use their nonprofit organizations, which the donors aren't disclosed to, don't have to be disclosed to. Other lawmakers have used them for community projects, like building a splash pad in their community. They've contributed to those through their nonprofit.
But the expenditures you've cited sound benign enough, but Emily, explain how it is the cash can't be traced.
Right. So a lot of this cash comes from corporations, at least in our finding. And corporations in Michigan can't legally donate to a candidate's regular campaign committee, but they're donating to these nonprofit and 527 groups. So, you know, you might be paying $500 for a splash pad in your local community or a contribution to that, but that money might have come from a corporate donor, perhaps with matters before the legislature, perhaps with matters in your committee. And that's not really clear because the donors oftentimes don't have to be disclosed.
Craig, we'll point out also that contributors to 527, you'll sometimes hear them say that they contribute to officials of both parties.
Mm-hmm.
When did 527 and administrative accounts become established, Craig? When did they become a part of the landscape?
Well, I think their presence and their impact in Lansing really took off after a decision in the 90s to do away with something that was called an office holder expense account. So these were accounts that were completely disclosed to the Secretary of State's office that donors, corporate donors, any donor could make a contribution to, and then the lawmaker could use the money in their office holder expense account for various office holder expenses as they were, as the funds were named. But when they decided to do away with those because of some of the excesses that were happening there, all of that activity did not stop. So lawmakers were railing against this activity, and they wanted to do away with it. But when they did away with the disclosed version of this, it all went underground into these administrative accounts and nonprofits. So the activity they were railing against is continuing, but it's just secret to the public now.
Emily, is there any kind of organized opposition to 527s or administrative accounts?
No, I think honestly, Craig and I's report just kind of tipped the iceberg, right? This is kind of the first public peek under the curtain about what's happening and how widespread it is. So, you know, there has been some pockets of opposition, for example, against Governor Snyder's Nerd Fund, which was one of those nonprofits that didn't disclose, and he ended up in making that inactive and going with a disclosing account. So I think on a case-by-case basis, there's been kind of an outcry, but as far as this overall picture of a third of state lawmakers being connected to nonprofit or administrative accounts, there's not been an organized opposition to that.
But Craig, I imagine since officials of both parties mm-hmm. are recipients of these funds, that must make it harder to get traction here. Am I reading that right?
No, that's exactly right. I mean, that's when you say where is the organized opposition to this, it's really from constituents. I mean, constituents are hearing about this and seem to be very frustrated by it from the emails that I've been getting since the investigation debuted. The problem with doing something about this is that the Michigan Republican Party, the Democratic Party of Michigan, they both have funds similar to this. Lawmakers on both sides of the aisle have funds similar to this. The caucuses, the House Democrats, the Senate Republicans, are tied to funds that are similar to this. So for a lawmaker to stand up and say, this is wrong, we should fix this, they would be speaking out against their own party mates, against people they meet with every day, and who people they're on the same political team as. And that's incredibly challenging to do in this current environment, and I think that's probably why you haven't seen an effort to do something about this.
Craig Mauger is with the Michigan Campaign Finance Director. He functions as executive director of that organization. MLive reporter Emily Lawler also joins me. We've been talking about their recent joint investigation into so-called 527 accounts and administrative accounts, which are so popular with so many elected members of the legislature. How many altogether? We've got 150 or thereabouts elected representatives.
Yep, there are 144 lawmakers right now, and there are 50 of these nonprofit and administrative accounts that we were able to trace.
What do you make? Have you gotten a response to your stories, Emily? And
yeah.
If so, how would you characterize it?
Yeah, Craig and I have both been getting emails from readers, constituents, who are pretty upset to learn about this, frankly, and surprised, I would say. A lot of my readers said, you know, I knew that money was getting into the system through kind of a backdoor, but I didn't realize the extent of it or that my lawmaker specifically was part of this.
Craig, where do you think this discussion's going?
Huh. I don't know if it will go anywhere in the legislature very quickly because, I mean, the top lawmakers are often the ones engaging in this type of activity, so it's unlikely that they're going to put a bill up to regulate themselves. I think it's on journalists like us and like members of the public to really inform lawmakers about what's going on here and to put these numbers in front of people so they can see the reality of the secret money. I mean, this is really secret money that is moving from people with matters before the legislature to lawmakers who are making decisions about them, about their policies. It's just important to keep shining a light on this activity.
We want to thank our guests, Craig Mauger of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network and MLive reporter Emily Lawler, a series of articles on MLive and with Craig. They work together on this, showing how common so-called 527 accounts are among elected officials in the Michigan legislature. Emily, Craig, thank you very much.
Thank you.
By the way, before the top of the hour, we will also take a look back at the Spartan loss and the Detroit Lions victory with Current Sports Al Martin. Al's along in just a few minutes. I'm Mark Bayshore. This is Current State on WKAR. You rely on your favorite news sources to keep you informed about what's happening in the world, but sometimes you need to know more than the what of current events. You need to know the why. NPR's social science correspondent Shankar Vedantam reports on human behavior and the social sciences to help the curious listener think about the news in unusual and interesting ways. And he takes this reporting even deeper as the host of the podcast Hidden Brain. Current State's Katie Cook had a conversation with Shankar about his reporting and the podcast a few days ago. She started by asking him what listeners can expect from an episode of Hidden Brain.
Well, Hidden Brain is a podcast that looks at the effects of the unconscious mind in everyday life, all of the ways in which factors that lie outside of our conscious awareness, things that we don't think about, might affect the way we see the world, make judgments, and the way we behave. We've looked at all manner of different things. One of the things we try and do with every episode is to try and make it relevant to people's lives. So we're especially interested in topics that touch people's lives, that can help them be better customers or better citizens or better employees or better parents, to provide practical advice in some ways that people can actually take and do something with. So Hidden Brain episodes come in a wide variety of forms. There are some episodes that are more narratively driven, where a story is sort of leading the way and it leads to interesting questions about human behavior. There are some episodes where a body of scientific research forms the main driver of the episode, and we build anecdotes and stories around the science as a way to illustrate the ideas.
Now, you wrote a book published in 2010 called The Hidden Brain, How Our Unconscious Minds Elect Presidents, Control Markets, Wage Wars, and Save Our Lives. So I'm wondering, how did the Hidden Brain idea turn into a podcast?
Well, I've been doing stories for the radio for a number of years since I joined NPR in 2011. And really, the idea for the podcast grew out of the radio stories that I was doing for NPR, which sort of looked at all manner of interesting social science research. And there has been a lot of interest in these stories over the years. A lot of people find them useful and interesting and share them with friends and family. And a lot of people would write to us and say, we would love to hear a deeper exploration of this idea. We would love to hear more on this subject. Or people write in with questions saying, you know, this happened to me yesterday as I was waiting in line at the bank. Why does that happen? What does social science research have to say? And so the podcast is really a vehicle for us to try and delve deeper into these subjects and from time to time to explore questions that our listeners tell us they're interested in hearing about.
What's the most fascinating thing you've learned since starting this podcast?
Well, you can ask me that question any day, any week, any month, and I'm always going to give you the same answer, which is whatever I'm doing right now is the most interesting thing that I've come by. I tend to get very excited with whatever it is that I'm working on at the moment. Our current podcast episode for the coming week looks at the social science research into why it is women find it very hard sometimes to achieve positions of high authority, whether that's in the political sphere or in the corporate sphere or in the nonprofit sector. There's been a lot of social science research looking at the very narrow path that women have to walk in order to sort of reach that high office. And I think it's just a fascinating set of ideas. It's obviously very topical. We've had prominent women on both the Republican and Democratic side this year who vied for the presidency. So there's a topicality to it. But I think this is also an issue that is going to outlive the presidential election because it's something that's going to be of interest to us for a long time.
And aren't you also exploring immigration in America in some recent episodes?
That's right. So the episode we had this past Tuesday looks at a historical view on immigration and this very interesting pattern that we see repeated over and over again in American history, where groups that have come to the United States often face prejudice and discrimination. And they're usually outraged about the fact that they face prejudice and discrimination because the United States is supposed to be a land of immigrants, a country of immigrants. And so people often complain about xenophobia. The interesting and ironic thing is that often within a very short period of being in the United States, sometimes as little as 15 or 20 years, the very same people now have concerns about the people who are coming to the United States after them. So they turn around and they express concerns about the newcomers and wonder if the newcomers are really going to fit in. What's interesting is that this pattern has repeated itself over and over and over again with multiple ethnic groups, national groups, religious groups. So you have to say that there's something about the way America works in relationship to immigration that somehow encourages this pattern of groups coming, encountering discrimination, being outraged by it, getting assimilated, and then discriminating in turn.
There's one topic you've covered that I found interesting, and it also has a Michigan connection. You were on NPR's Morning Edition this past July, and you were talking about a study that was done on the effects of the Ban the Box laws. And those laws are the ones that prevent employers from requiring that applicants declare whether they have criminal records on their applications. So Sonia Starr of the University of Michigan was one of the authors of a study that looked at the effects of these laws. Can you tell us what that study found?
The new research that I featured on Morning Edition was looking at some of the counterintuitive and unpredicted effects of these laws. It basically found that some employers, when they were prevented from asking people about their criminal history, essentially started extrapolating criminal histories to people from various racial groups. So, for example, if African Americans are more represented among people who have criminal records, the effect of Ban the Box laws effectively meant that many employers said, let's simply not call in African Americans at all for interviews because they're more likely to be represented among people who have criminal histories. And so far from producing the effect, which in some ways was to reduce racial discrimination, the laws might have had a counterproductive effect. Now, a lot of people have criticized that study and sort of said, look, the problem is not the Ban the Box laws. The problem is that many employers are essentially applying racist standards as they're going about seeking candidates. And what we should do as a society is to try and fix the racism, not necessarily go after the Ban the Box laws. You know, I don't have a policy position or a policy view about the question, but it raises sort of this interesting thing, which is that lawmakers and policymakers sometimes devise policies with the very best of intentions, but it's not until you actually study how they actually work in practice that you can actually find out if the law is having the desired effect.
Thank you, Shankar.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
I've been speaking with NPR's science correspondent, Shankar Vedantam. He's also the host of the podcast Hidden Brain. You can hear full episodes of the Hidden Brain podcast at npr.org/hiddenbrain or wherever you get your podcasts. You will also hear Shankar from time to time on NPR's Morning Edition, weekday mornings from 5 to 9 here on WKAR. For Current State, I'm Katie Cook.
Katie also spoke with Shankar Vedantam about other topics, including the concept of counter-stereotyping. To hear the rest of their conversation, visit WKAR.org. Well, the Michigan State football team hasn't lost four straight games dating back to 2006 during the John L. Smith era. That same year, the Spartans also had an 0-4 Big Ten start. Fans of the team are certainly having flashbacks this year as the Spartans were handed a 54-40 loss by Northwestern at home this past weekend. Many are just hoping to see a bowl game for the team this year. Current sports host Al Martin joins us now by phone to break down why the Spartans are reeling, as well as a little bit about our streaking, if that's not an overstatement, streaking Detroit Lions. Hi, Al.
How you doing, Mark? Good to hear from you.
Just great. Great to check in with you on Monday as usual. We're a year removed from making the college football playoff, Al. Did you ever think we'd see a four-game losing streak this year?
No, nobody saw this coming, Mark. I mean, come on. I mean, this is, again, college football playoff last year. And what's even more remarkable, if you look at the list of teams that made the college football playoff last year, again, four stout teams, Alabama and Clemson, of course, they're ranked in the top 10 right now. Oklahoma is ranked 16th, according to the latest AP poll, and then Michigan State, four straight losses in jeopardy of starting the Big Ten year 0-4. And MSU has not had a 2-4 record dating all the way back to when I was 4 years old back in 1994, the final year of actually George Perlis. That's a long time, Mark. Nobody, and I do mean nobody, saw this coming.
What allowed the Wildcat offense to carve up our defense for almost 500 yards?
Yeah, I think what you saw in that game, Mark, is what you've seen from the MSU defense throughout much of this year. I've been really harping on when it comes to Michigan State. When it comes to third downs, they have just constantly giving up big play after big play. Northwestern's offense on third down this past weekend, Mark, they were 10 of 19. 8 yards per pass attempt, almost 5 yards per rush attempt. There's too many injuries on the defensive side of the football right now. Now, again, they did get their leader in Riley Bulla back. We haven't seen Riley Bulla since that Notre Dame game, one of the few positives for this Michigan State season so far. But Riley Bulla did come back, but again, he's just coming off an injury, so his impact was very limited in this game. Clayton Thorson and Justin Jackson, they were absolutely fantastic. And I think they realized pretty early, I would say probably around the second quarter, that Michigan State secondary, if you test them, they will eventually break. And I think we saw that time and time again throughout this game as well, Mark.
We've got Mark D'Antonio putting a lot of different options out on the table. First and foremost, getting quarterback Brian Lewerke his first start. What does Coach D'Antonio do? Shift some more things around? How do we get this train back on the track?
Well, I tell you what, and you mentioned Brian Lewerke, Mark. That was the big storyline coming into this game. Who exactly was going to suit up as the starting quarterback, seeing as though the week prior we saw Tyler O'Connor benched, actually in favor of Damian Terry. We didn't see Brian Lewerke in that game. But the way Brian Lewerke started that game, Mark, 73 yards in the first quarter, led a scoring drive with a 24-yard scramble and a first TD pass to Josiah Price. And I'm sitting there saying to myself, okay, you know, maybe they have something here. And then you see, you know, Justin Lane picked off Clayton Thorson for a pick six. And MSU was up, if you remember, 14-0 early on in that game.
Right.
Northwestern then scores on a 29-yard TD by Jackson. And then MSU gets a 41-yard field goal by Geiger. After that point, though, Mark, after that Geiger field goal, the offense goes completely ghost recon. Couldn't find them the entire game. Northwestern scores 26 straight points. And then I think Mark D'Antonio said, you know what? The offense isn't moving. Let me put Tyler O'Connor back in the game. And if you compare the numbers, O'Connor actually had a better outing than Lewerke did. O'Connor comes in 13 of 21, 281 yards. He did throw a pick, but he had 3 touchdowns to kind of equalize that. I think right now, and I've said this all year too, I think O'Connor is the guy. When it comes to putting the wheels back on the track, though, right now I wouldn't want to be in the position that Mark D'Antonio is in right now because there are so many things going wrong. I really don't know where to start.
Maryland fell to Minnesota at home on Saturday. We are in College Park next Saturday. We've got to talk about the Lions here, though, before we're through. They found late-game answers again, beating the L.A. Rams at home, now to create a 2-game winning streak. What do you like about the way the Lions are playing?
How impressive have they been these last 2 weeks, Mark? And specifically when it comes to just pulling off wins in clutch opportunities, because we've seen the Lions time and time again, you know, right there in the game, close game, and just fumble it, you know, in the final minutes. But we're seeing the exact opposite. We've seen the exact opposite the last 2 weeks here. And what's particularly impressive, I mean, Matthew Stafford's poise in the clutch. I mean, this is back-to-back weeks now where in the final minute he's led the team down the field, and all of a sudden Matt Prater, you know, uses his foot to give the Lions the eventual dub. And not to mention that there was a possession for both the opposition these last 2 weeks in which they could have had an opportunity to pull off a miracle. Both times the game has been sealed with an interception. Very impressive stuff. Matthew Stafford has looked great. The Lions defense, I mean, they limited Todd Gurley for 14 carries for 58 yards. I mean, this is one of the premier backs in the National Football League. He was contained, but I will say this. The Lions offense did forget about that passing game. Case Keenum, 321 yards, 3 touchdowns. At one point, he completed 19 straight passes. If anything, that's one of the glaring holes in the boat. But right now, hey, a win is a win, and nobody's complaining if the Lions pull out a win, Mark.
More sports this afternoon at 1 p.m. on AM 870. It's Current Sports. Al Martin, thank you very much.
Mark, anytime. Thank you.
That's our show for today. Coming up Tuesday on Current State, the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame will induct a new class of honorees. We'll talk with the Hall's Caitlin Dial about the class of 2016. And America's in the throes of an opioid drug epidemic. The recent image of a man and woman near death in the front seat of a car with a small child in the back has helped bring the crisis into critically sharp focus. Police and physicians say the problem's been building for years. We'll talk with a Sparrow Hospital physician and a Detroit area medication program manager about opioid treatment strategies. A critically important story here in Michigan. You'll hear it tomorrow on Current State. The executive producer of Current State is Peter Wharf. Katie Cook directed the show today. Thanks also to Scott Pohl, Kevin Lavery, Jamie Paisley, Brooke Allen, and to Drew Hill. Don't forget the Current State podcast. Everything we do on the program ends up at the podcast. Check it out anywhere, anytime at iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Bayshore. See you tomorrow on Current State.